Recording.
Okay, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, everyone out there. Welcome to a special one-off book club. My name's Andy Kirk, and I'm the volunteer host for this special session where myself, Alberto Cairo, Jose Camues, and Stephanie Evergreen are discussing our experiences, our reflections from writing and publishing some books recently and indeed in the near future. So the format of this is going to be quite open, but we're going to kind of go around each person first of all just for some very short introductions, and then we'll work through alphabetically with a little bit of a kind of Q&A for each person, asking them about certain aspects of their experiences, and then we'll pick up some questions that we receive from Twitter people out there asking specific tips and tactics about our experiences, and then we'll just kind of wrap things up. So first of all, let's kind of go around the virtual room in alphabetical order. So Alberto, over to you, sir, just to kind of introduce yourself, and then we'll move on to the next person, then come back to you again with the chance for you to describe your most recent book.
Sure. I am Alberto Cairo. I am a professor at the University of Miami, where I teach infographics and data visualization. And my latest book is The Truthful Art, Data Charts and Maps for Communication.
Jorge?
So my name is Jorge Camões. I am a data visualization and Excel consultant, and I blog about these things in excelcharts.com. My book is titled Data at Work, Best Practices for Creating Effective Charts and Information Graphics in Microsoft Excel, and was released in April by PitchBit.
Great.
And I'm Stephanie Evergreen. I'm a consultant as well, doing a lot of design and traveling all over to give workshops, rivaling Andy, I think, in airline miles. And I've got a PhD in research and evaluation. My second book just came out last month. It's Effective Data Visualization, The Right Chart for the Right Data, and it was published by Sage.
Excellent. And also, myself, Andy Kirk, I'm a freelance data visualization specialist based in the UK. Trainer, teacher, researcher, designer, consultant, all sorts of different things, blogger as well. And like Stephanie, I'm part of the Sage stable, and my book, which is due out hopefully in 3 weeks, Data Visualization, A Handbook for Data-Driven Design, which is my second book, and I'll come on to my experiences of the first book in due course. But excellent introductions, people, so let's kick off with Alberto. So Alberto, this is your third book, correct?
Yes, it is my third book, but the second one that is published in the American market. First one about data visualization was published just in Spain. So this is the Truthful Art is the follow-up to The Functional Art, which is the first book that I published in the American market, actually worldwide. So it's the second one, actually. Yeah.
So just give us a sense of what the book's about, who it's for, and also perhaps who it's not for, which I think is always an important aspect of this.
Yeah, well, the book is written like I wrote the first book. I basically pictured myself a decade ago thinking about what I didn't know and I should have known 10 years ago, something like that, and then I decided to write about it. That's how I wrote The Functional Art, which is a book that I wrote for my students to teach my design and communication with students how to communicate better using infographics and data visualization. So The Functional Art is more related to that. Second book, The Truthful Art, the most recent one, also deals with that, also deals with how to communicate using data visualization, but it focuses a little bit more on what comes before you even design the chart, meaning data reasoning and even a little bit of statistics. So the book was written for those communicators, journalists, graphic designers like me, didn't have any formal training on statistics, or they forgot the formal training that they had when they were in college in statistical reasoning, and then how to apply that knowledge in statistics to visualization. So explaining how you basically how you need to handle the data, how you can operate on the data, how you can extract meaning from the data before you even present it, how you make sure that the data is the proper data, the data that you need,
right,
and enough quality before you even present it to the public, and then how to present it. So the Truthful Art is basically my empire strikes back, if you want to put it. There will be a Return of the Jedi 4 years from now, or something like that. So it's the middle book, right?
Oh my God.
And I believe that as the Empire Strikes Back, it's a better book than the first one.
Oh, it's going to get political around here in just
a
minute.
Yeah.
There's no Jar Jar Binks in this one, then, no.
So Alberto, I think all three of you actually spent a lot of time talking about the things you need to do before you start designing a visualization. But I really appreciated your walkthrough of statistics. I mean, that's my PhD, but it's rare that you see somebody who can say it in such a way that it doesn't feel so scary.
Yeah. Well, that was mainly my goal. I mean, and I had some pushback. I mean, some people, I remember one reviewer on Amazon.com for my first book, someone who wrote a review of my first book on Amazon.com. It was kind of positive. He gave me 3 stars, but he said, this guy is not an engineer. And you can notice, he's not an engineer because he writes in such a lighthearted tone. And I said, well, that's exactly the point. That's how I write. I mean, I write for people who are like me, right? I don't write for scientists or for statisticians. This is not a book for statisticians. It's not a book for scientists. Although later on, I usually discover that my books are read by statisticians and scientists. Mm. But that is not my intended audience. My intended audience is basically the lay public. And I include in that graphic designers and journalists who, unfortunately, we don't have any formal training. And we should have formal training in mathematical reasoning and in statistics. So the book is written in a very lighthearted tone, in purpose, just because I want to make that kind of very elementary statistical reasoning approachable, understandable. And I also want to show how fun it can be and how enlightening it can be to be able to reason about numbers. Even if it is just at a very elementary level, you can extract a lot of very interesting meanings from the numbers if you just understand these very basic concepts. So all that is done in purpose.
So just another question, Albert. So the Functional Art was a very well-received, popular book. Does the Truthful Art reflect new things that you know about the subject and you know about yourself, or is it kind of unfinished business that you didn't really have the space and the time to include in that first? Because, as I'm sure we'll all touch on, in a sense, the art of book writing is editing, is what you leave out, and there's always that kind of that sense of perhaps being overly precious about, oh, I want to include everything that I want to say.
Yeah, and so
where would you kind of position yours, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the book reflects things that I was not so sure about, or I didn't have enough knowledge about. Some things I didn't have enough knowledge about 5 years ago or 6 years ago. It also reflects things that I would like to have included in the functional arts, such as the part about the statistical reasoning. And it also reflects things that I have been thinking about in the past 3 years or 4 years, such as, you know, the evolution of and the changes that interactive graphics have experienced in the past few years, particularly in the media, with the increase of what in the news media is called news applications, which is a step beyond mere data visualization. It's a kind of data visualization that puts the reader at the center, meaning that instead of, for example, showing you, I don't know, the entire distribution of income in the United States, right, with a histogram, it first asks you, what is your monthly income? And then it shows you in the histogram, where you are in comparison to the rest of people. I call that the me factor, and we see it at work in many graphics nowadays. This is not my idea, by the way. I got inspired by people who work at places like ProPublica, the New York Times, the Washington Post, who are applying this principle, this idea, really, really well. So I got inspired by them, and I try to reflect on that, on what I had learned from them, and organize my thoughts a little bit in the book.
And I think, you know, it's a clever or torturous way to build in new additions, because for all of us, like this field is, continues to grow and change, and so you know we're going to have to continue to update these books.
It is, all of our books right now. We will get into this discussion in just 1 minute. They complement each other really well. There are certainly some areas of overlap, but each one of them offers something different. But there are areas that we don't cover really well or at all, perhaps, which is, for example, the fact that most people access our content through mobile devices, through cell phones, right? We still write our books like if we're going to print our graphic out or we're going to put our graphic, our visualization on a computer screen. But and that may be true in the case of those of you who work with businesses, right? If you work in business intelligence, people perhaps they use their computers to analyze their data. But the regular consumer, the regular reader, which is the kind of public that I'm interested in, 70 or 80% of them access their news through the mobile phone. That poses poses huge challenges for the future, and it's something that I would like to address in the Return of the Jedi.
The mobile art.
Exactly. How to design for mobile. Good practices, bad practices on infographics, on designing infographics for mobile applications, for mobile devices.
I think there's an entire podcast on that subject alone, actually. Excellent stuff, Albert. Let's bounce on to Georgia. I think it's what's interesting. Georgia, is this your first book?
Yes, it is.
Yeah? So what? Yeah. Just give a sense of the overall premise of the book, who it's for, who it's not for, and why did you do it?
I wrote the book because I wanted to find if I could have a framework for Excel users, a data visualization framework. I don't think the current frameworks work. The ones from graphic designers don't work. And the other one for more business users also leaves something out, like emotions and aesthetics. So I wanted to try to find a better framework. So I defined a three-part book, like a story, where there is a kingdom, there is the evil queen, there is the actions of the characters, and that translates into the book for like the foundations of data visualization, perception, culture, data, etc. That's the kingdom. Then the charts themselves are the characters, and how we design the charts, how they answer the questions. Those are the actions of each character. So that was the plan. I designed the book like.
Yeah, I loved your metaphor for that, the whole storytelling and kingdom metaphor, because you talked about how you should work to title your chart so that it sort of answers that now you know, which you always get at the end of those stories. And it was such a beautiful way to like frame how to be thinking about the title of your chart, Now You Know.
Yeah.
Yeah, really nice.
Thank you.
And obviously it's framed around Excel, and Excel for a lot of people is often seen as the great limiter in visualization. You know, that you've got very limited chart types, you've got very limited expressiveness in the elegance of the chart types. But clearly you've managed to find a whole new whole new kind of expressiveness with Excel, because it's just incredible. I know Alberto's tweeted about this a few times, but you know, as a canvas for visualization work, I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes to this as a viable tool in this space. So obviously your deep history is as an Excel master, but obviously you spotted a gap in the market, in particular, I guess, for Excel and visualization coming together, correct?
I don't try to make beautiful charts. That's the first thing. I try to understand the limits of Excel. How do I answer the question? And my tool is Excel. So I have to find ways to to express myself through Excel. When I try to use Tableau, I always fail. so I have to work with Excel. I don't think it's Excel users, Excel tweeters, bloggers tend to focus on the how to do within the framework of the library, but they don't try to find new ways of expressing and focusing on data visualization and not on the tool. I try to flip that around and focus on data visualization and not the tool. I think that it works.
I will have to disagree on something with you. You say that you don't focus on creating beautiful charts, but all the charts that you created for the book are amazing. They look they look beautiful. They show a very sophisticated understanding of typography, color, composition. So it's more than a book about Excel. It's a book about graphic design in Excel, in my opinion at least. And it illustrates the ideas really well through the examples. So I would have to disagree with that. The question that I have with you is, I know that you are allowing people to download the charts from the book's website. Are you planning to do tutorials on how to create those charts in Excel?
I'm planning to, yes. okay. The idea is to let people download, and I'm trying to select the few harder ones and use those ones to write tutorials in the blog. Yeah.
Great. Perfect. Yeah. I'm going to nominate your connected scatterplot.
Okay.
That's a cool one. Yeah. yeah. I would nominate the horizon chart and the sequence of maps with the expansion of Walmart over the United States.
Okay.
The small multiples one, I really love that one.
Okay.
It's a really good one. Really good one.
So, with it being your first book, what are your reflections, frustrations, things that you've enjoyed, things you've that kind of stand out for you? Because obviously, I think myself and Stephanie and Alberto are at least onto number two or three. So, we've kind of been through a lot of pain already and suffering and despair and never will we write a book again. And then obviously we come back and write a book again. Idiots. So, you know, how would you kind of summarize your first book experience?
Well, I think we become addicted to that pain. it was great. I had the chance to work with great people, so I had no bad experiences from the publisher side. I wrote what I wanted to write. I didn't have to change anything from my initial drafts. So it was hard. It was painful. Family-wise also, it was not easy. I'm not sure if my wife wants me to write a new book. Probably not.
Just make sure you keep dedicating them to her. It'll help a little bit.
Okay. But I'll do it again, yes.
That sounds like a good experience. Because obviously, if you can reflect on that process, knowing that what has been produced is your work and is the work that you can put your name to with a sense of pride, then that's really, I think, as almost as good as it gets in this game, really. So that's excellent.
Yeah.
Stephanie? Sage? Stablemate?
Sage is forever.
Sage as well, yeah?
Sage for life, yeah.
So why did you go back?
Well, there was more to say, that's for sure. I mean, I think you finish the first book and then you think you said everything there is, and then you just keep evolving, and so there's just more to talk about. So my second book is more of a manual, like literally a manual on how to create these awesome charts inside Excel. Because like we've been discussing already, people don't quite realize all the things that you can do with it. They think it's just like, you know, for spreadsheets or really bad pie charts or something. Mm-hmm. So being able to show people what you can do is great. And I mean, my first book had examples of what those kinds of things look like. Like, here's a dot plot. But then the question is always, well, how do I get Excel to make that? And a lot of my workshops are composed of that. So I figured this way I can travel a little less because those people will see it in the book.
Yeah.
And that'll give them the step-by-step guide that they need.
It's interesting you say that, actually. Just to interrupt.
Sure.
The kind of career suicide in some respects that it creates, because you don't need to be there in person at perhaps a higher rate than the cost of the book. But in a sense, it's a gateway to you as an expert as well, which I think is a kind of a byproduct.
I believe you.
that's actually what I appreciated the most about the book, and that's the reason why I believe that Stephanie's book and George's book complement each other so well, because Stephanie provides the step-by-step guidance on how to create some elementary but at the same time beautiful charts, bar charts, line charts, etc., in Excel, how to do it properly. And then George's work as now that you have learned all these really, really well in Stephanie's book, just open your eyes of how, you know, at how powerful Excel can be. Because that was eye-opening for me in both of your books. I mean, showing how flexible the tool can be. I was never aware that Excel was so flexible. I always went, mm-hmm. you know, whenever I want to do a complex chart, I go to R and ggplot2 and I just code it. Or use one mm-hmm. of graphical user interfaces in R. I never thought about Excel. I use Excel for things such as pivot tables and things like that, but not for information, mm-hmm. right? So both your books, in that sense, provide that kind of feeling, right? They open your eyes.
Yeah, well, and the truth is, most of the people that I work with, most of my design clients, most of the people who ask me to come out to do workshops are living in a Microsoft Office world.
Yeah.
And they have very full day-to-day jobs that where they don't have budgets or time to learn some new software or how to code. So it's just really trying to hit them where they are so that they can take that next step.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the book does that really, really well.
And in terms of your kind of writing approach, Stephanie, how soon after you wrote the first book did you have this book, this structure, this content in mind? Was it kind of almost like a reaction to the first book? In writing the first book, it kind of clarified your convictions, clarified about how you want to explain the subject, and you kind of came back and thought, right, here's another take on the subject.
I went a full year after the first book was published thinking I'm never writing again.
Right.
Because I had just done a dissertation, and then I went straight into a book, and I was, like, wanting some of my life back. And so I had a full year where I took bike rides, and my garden looked fantastic, and it was really lovely. And then this was just coming out of me. It just had to be done. I mean, the workshops, sort of, you know, in that process of developing workshops, the content all came along. And then, of course, having a blog, as you all know, it's a great place to start launching some of that material and see what kind of traction you get from it. So eventually there was just enough accumulated that the book had to be written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what's interesting, so one of the questions that we got asked, and if I can find it very quickly, from Neil Richards. How do you find a unique angle for a book so it's not, in quotes, just another DataViz book? So, and I'm going to come back to perhaps everyone to respond to this in a second, but did you apply any kind of methodology to kind of create a sense of the space, the landscape of visualization books, and this is where this would fit, or was it very much more about a kind of bottom-up approach about this is what I want to write and hopefully we'll find its voice and its audience?
It's a little bit of both, but it's mostly this is what people need. This is what the people need who call me and want help. And I thought it was really interesting. We all kind of show different taxonomies because my book is based on my taxonomy for how I think about choosing the right chart type. And we all kind of went through that. But I did that research before I got started and saw what I thought were gaps. I think we all did. That's why we were talking about them in our books. But just trying to approach it in a way that I thought would make more sense to the main people who are going to use it.
Right. And I think, I mean, the fact is that the field is evolving all the time. The shape, the characteristics, the makeup, the membership of the field is different from 1 6-month period to the next. So to take a line in the sand and say this is what the field looks like at one point immediately is expired when you come to actually finish a book. So
by the time you're done writing, yeah, like it's all changed.
Exactly right. So you have to the kind of clarity about your own sense about where you think the field is going, which obviously, you know, for all of us, I guess we have different contact points with the client world, with the marketplace out there, and you have to take those kind of fingertip judgments about where people are asking questions and they're not currently possibly able to
but
get
answers
down.
At the same time, there are certain things that are, so to speak, timeless. I don't think that, for example, the principles that all of you are teaching in the books are going to be passé anytime soon. I mean, they are...
Right.
So I wouldn't dare saying that they are universal and they would last forever, but certainly they have a very long life. They are not software dependent. Even if Stephanie and Giorgio, for example, focus on Excel, it is not likely that Excel will disappear anytime soon, right?
No.
So and it is not likely that it will change that much either. I mean, it will change on the in the boundaries perhaps, in the outskirts, but the core. The core principles and the core functionality of the software is unlikely to change deeply, at least in the near future. So, but we have not talked about your book, Andy.
Yes, okay. Andy Stern.
What is your experience writing a book? Why did you decide to write a book in the first place?
Well, so this is book number two. Book number one was an interesting experience.
When I wrote, and
Alberto was involved as one of my kind of peer reviewers of this, of the first book, so he's a bit more acquainted with the frustrations of the first book. But when I wrote the first book, I don't think I was ready to write a book. And it was one of those things that came along as an opportunity to think, this may not arrive again. And so I've got a choice. Do I go for it, or do I wait for the next bus to arrive and hopefully it's there's a place for me to do that? So I jumped in both feet in the first book, and I guess what I pulled together as a book was pretty much everything that I knew at that point. The book was printed in black and white, and that was an immensely frustrating and bizarre approach to printing a book about data visualization, especially when you've got a colour chapter. So this was very much unfinished business. So it wasn't so much a sequel as a reboot of book number one, I guess. But the premise that I've kind of followed in this book, which is consistent, I guess, as with Stephanie just mentioned there, is consistent with my teaching, my training, is that data visualization to me is a game of decisions. And you've got all these different moments, all these different elements of decision making. To make good decisions, I believe you need to be aware of all the options and aware of all the things that influence what will be the right choice. So, of course, there are certain rules that have a certain universality, but there's also a lot of grey shades, a lot of fingertip sensors. So what I try and achieve in this book is a kind of four-stage methodology which gives people a sense of how to think about tackling any data viz challenge. So it's tool agnostic. We don't go into any specifics about tools. It's about giving them a sense of everything that they need to think about in data viz and some sense of a roadmap through that kind of chaos, really, to a certain degree. I mean, one of the interesting things that you kind of touched on, Alberto, in a sense that you almost were framing the audience of your book around what you would have wanted to have seen 10 years ago or so. And that's kind of what my approach has been for this, although I was given a quite clear demographic, as in social scientists and kind of postgrad students, undergrad students, it's actually very hard to just write for them because data viz is not necessarily, or it is not at all, something that you can just box off as only being for these people or only being for these people. Of course, there are special applications of it when it comes to scientific visualization, medical. But largely, it is a portable, replicable craft, regardless of domain. The interpretations and the meaning of what you're showing people is different, of course. And so it's a very portable craft. So it actually was very hard to just write to those very specific people I was told to write to. And so the drift is quite difficult. You got a question,
yeah,
Stephanie?
Andy, one of the things I wanted to say, I got the same direction. I think that's just a product of publishing a stage. So, yeah, you know, told to write to a very specific crowd of undergraduate and graduate students. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I really liked about your book was that workflow that you were describing and the role of the brief.
Right.
I thought that was so helpful. And, I mean, just throughout, you had tips for designers, which, I mean, when I say tips for designers, that totally does not even come close to covering what you are really doing here, but it's like you're giving people, like if I'm the creative director of a data viz company, you're giving them the insight and the lay of the land in such a nice way that it's like, that's exactly what it's right. You don't learn that until you're 3 years in, and Andy's just spelling it out there for you. And I think that that makes the book such a broader appeal than just the geographic you got.
I really appreciate that, because one of the kind of multiple entry points I was looking for this book, it wasn't just makers, it was commissioners, and it was consumers, readers, however you want to kind of position them. We may not all be makers, but we are all readers, so we need to have that literacy to read and make sense of and understand what different charts are showing. Just because you are exposed to a new chart type doesn't mean it's wrong. It actually reflects on you and your deficit in a literary sense. So the idea as well, thinking back to the idea of the types of people this was being written for, was also in mind the people who might run research projects, who might not get their hands on the data or make the thing, but they need to have the language and the kind of guidance to say, okay, colleagues, this is how we're going to tackle this task to create this visualization as a product of this research. Very ambiguous statement there, but hopefully that comes across that it isn't just for makers, it is for different people with different roles in this game.
I think all three of your books actually did that so well, where someone who does not necessarily make the data viz but needs to be literate in it, like, they're going to be able to pick up all three of your books and get so much out of it. Whereas mine, they're going to be like, whoa, this is so not for me. Mine's more for like the boots on the ground people.
Well, but yours is laid out in such a nice way and clear manner that I believe that even in someone who doesn't have any sort of previous experience with it will be able to just pick it up and follow the instructions and be able to produce at least a small chart in a very quick way. So I think that in that sense, it addresses the same kind of people, because one of the things that I have discovered in my career, and I speak from the world of journalism and graphic design, as you know, it is not possible, at least I believe that it's really, really hard to direct a department of visualization of and graphics if you don't know how to produce a graphic.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't have, at least if you're not familiar with the tools, even if you're not, you know, a high-end programmer, at least you know you need to know the basic concepts of programming in order to direct a department of programmers. So it's the same thing with graphics and infographics and data visualization. The people who most successfully lead graphics desks out there in the world of journalism are very accomplished graphic designers and visualization designers, beginning with, you know, Steve Duenis from the New York Times or Kat Downs at the Washington Post and many others all over the world.
Right.
Leaders are usually people who have very good skills in terms of management, but at the same time, even if they are not up to date with every single tool and every single technology and every single programming language and whatever, they still have a past that allows them to understand what the tools are capable of, what people who work for them are capable of, and also in an extreme situation, in an urgent or an emergency situation, they will be able to create a graphic themselves, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's almost like role of a coach.
Yeah, exactly.
Just because you can't be the best basketball player doesn't mean you know what's possible in the sport and how to perhaps go about developing that skill set.
Sure.
I think one last point which might kind of lead on to a discussion, really, is just, as I mentioned, the first book, in terms of its production value, was bad, really bad. Black and white, as I mentioned. And not just black and white, but cheap paper, really awful paper. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that kind of weighs quite heavily on your shoulders as a an author, as a writer, is that the book that goes out into the wild is not just the product of your own work. It's actually often, unless you're purely self-publishing, unless you remortgage the house and start producing books by hand in the garage, it's got other people's footprint, and you are therefore judged on a team. Now, it's kind of a different role to, say, a director of a movie, who has really had a role in everything. You are the writer. You've done the screenplay, but you've not done the special effects. You've not done the audio, the production. So one of the things that I really appreciated from this experience was just how good the people I worked with at Sage, the editors, the layout people, the designers. You know, everyone was very much on the same page. And like Georgia mentioned, what's produced, I can actually hold up now and say, yes, I'm happy to have my name on that book. And I don't think when you buy a book, when you've not written a book, and certainly this is something I experienced before writing, you don't see all those hidden roles, the cast and crew that's behind the scenes.
Mm. Yeah.
And they are so important.
Mm-hmm.
The role is
and there are so many.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we've got a few questions. We may have covered off some of these questions already, but let me just kind of go through them. So David Perez asked, what's the main motivation? Why do you write? Well, I think we've all kind of touched on this, really, in terms of our own perspectives. I mean, one of the things that, certainly from my perspective, influenced me writing any book at all was that I always found that by writing about something, you learn what you know and don't know. You get a sense, if you can't communicate it to somebody else, you don't quite probably understand what you're trying to talk about. And I recall this current book, the colour chapter, was that real moment of, actually, do I really know about colour? I think I know about colour, but actually when you ask the questions about colour, there's so much more that you need to kind of equip yourself. You may not even write about the stuff that you've equipped yourself with, but it kind of clarifies what you understand. So I think the motivation for me has always been about that kind of byproduct of it will help me grow and develop my own skills and capabilities just by writing.
It forces you to organize your thoughts and to gain more knowledge if you want to write. But there's another reason we all write, I believe, which is that, and again, I speak like the journalist and graphic designer in the room. As a journalist, I like to convey information, right? I like to gather tons of stuff that is unorganized or chaotic or ununderstandable, impossible to understand. I like to organize it and then just, you know, bring in my own, you know, little knowledge if possible, and I'd like to package that and then deliver it to the public. And we all do that for many different reasons, just because we have that drive naturally to communicate with others the things that we have learned, right? See how cool this thing is, right? And you want to explain it to others, right? Yeah. It happened to me, for example, when I started learning cartography many years ago, reading about maps, etc. It was so cool. I just wanted to implement that. I wanted to include that in my classes and in my books. And there is a chapter about maps in The Truthful Art, just because I feel so enthusiastic about that kind of knowledge that is not common knowledge among journalists and graphic designers, how to produce good maps. But that is something that exists in other areas. So you borrow from those areas and you transfer that knowledge from one area to another area. And there is another reason why I believe that we all do it, and we touched on it before. I mean, writing these books save people a lot of time, because all the things that we write about are things that basically cause a lot of trouble in our lives to figure it out. It took me, for example, years and years and years of hitting the wall with my head to figure out how to build a good infographic. Then later on, I was able to distill some certain, so to speak, rules, quotation mark in there, or certain guidelines that can help you create a good information graphic. All right, and I try to put them in an organized manner in the book. And whoever reads those chapters will save all those 3 or 4 years that took me to figure it out myself. Right. Mm-hmm. So we all try to contribute to the community somehow. somehow, right?
Well, and I'll add another reason why we all write the books. The main motivation I think we all have is because that's how you get rich.
But not from the royalties.
Yeah. Those royalty checks, woo! Yeah,
oh, wow,
gosh,
so huge.
$12. Woo!
Family to dinner, perhaps.
There you go. But I did want to point out something that you brought up twice now, Alberto, and I think it was in answering a question that Andy pitched from somebody on Twitter earlier, which is like, how do you write something new? Mm-hmm. And I think it's everybody is contributing a bit. But everybody's also building off of the work that everybody else has already done that we're all steeped in. And so it is about like applying new ideas in new ways and to new crowds and new situations. And so you're not going to ever have a Dataviz book that doesn't have a reference, right? Like every book is building off of the work everyone else has done. So it's okay to do that and to just put your own spin on it and give credit.
Yeah,
to those people.
Absolutely.
That's how every single field works.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every single field works. I mean, nobody writes, you know, in a cocoon. We are all, mm-hmm. building up over, you know, what has been done before. And that belief mm-hmm. that's perfectly normal, acceptable, and as long as you give people credit for their work, it's how the world works. So
mm-hmm.
there's no other.
Mm-hmm.
Another question kind of linked to this, I guess, is from Matt Johnston, which says, what has writing a book done for you professionally and indeed personally? Georgie, what do you think about this from your perspective?
It's too soon to tell.
Married, so that's one thing.
Yeah. it personally got me 10 kilos fatter, so I have to deal with that. I'm starting to get some contacts from people that heard about the book, so let's see how it goes.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think in a sense the motive is also as a credential builder, it's a marketing device.
Yeah.
Whether you want to, whether you're comfortable with that term or not, it is a sense of this is what I know and what I can perhaps offer in a different guise. I mean, we all get involved in teaching and training in different ways, but you know, a book just kind of substantiates, I guess, the credibility of your offering, really. And obviously, it then feeds back into the materials that you can use. So
mm-hmm.
there is a kind of a cyclical benefit to it, really. Some other questions. Let's pick one.
I would like to challenge that question. So there's another thing that you can learn from writing a book, which is how to discipline yourself. Because one of the things that I couldn't figure out before writing the first book was how to organize my time in an efficient manner.
Mm.
And the first and the second book, the one that was published just in Spain, and then the Functional Art, forced me to figure out what kind of a schedule worked better or best for me. For instance, there are certain kinds of writers who are able to wake up in the morning, write for a couple of hours, and then, you know, get breakfast and then do something else. I cannot do that. I'm not that kind of person. So the book forces you to discover what kind of person you are. And the kind of person that I discover that I am is that I need to devote days to single tasks. So the way I write books is that I divide my weeks into days, and then I devote days to certain tasks. So, for instance, Tuesday, Thursday are teaching days. So I teach my classes, get ready for classes, prepare materials, blah, blah, blah. Wednesday may be the day for class preparation or something like that. Friday is a day for conferences, consulting, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Monday is the writing day. And Sunday afternoon sometimes is the preparation for writing day. So mm-hmm. I may prepare for writing on Sunday afternoon, and then I devote Monday, the entire day, just to write. That's how I discover that I can become more productive. But again, this is not something that is applicable to everybody. Everybody needs to discover mm-hmm. what kind of a schedule will enable them to be more productive. As I said before, there are certain people who are able to focus for just 1 hour and write for 1 hour and then move on and switch tasks. I cannot do that.
We had a question kind of related to this too, which was like, how do you make the time to write. Mm. And it's so interesting to hear your layout of that, Alberto, because you teach, so your schedule is pretty set. You know you're going to be on certain days of the week during certain hours. I think for at least me, maybe you too, Andy, it's a little bit different because we're on the road so much. Mm. So there's no set schedule week to week. So I can't just carve out Mondays like that. So my strategy was I went to a retreat center. I would book myself a couple times a year out at a retreat center where it's so far, it's a silent retreat center, it's way far out in the middle of nowhere, there's no internet, there's no telephone, there's no TV, no one can contact me, and that's the only time I can really get it done.
Yeah, yeah, but that is hard because in my case, for instance, I use the internet a lot, as you know. So Twitter is my note-taking device, for example, and I use it constantly. And so I cannot really, but it's good. That's something that you pointed out is really important. You need to find a way to discipline yourself, to isolate yourself from the world. That's the most important thing. And if that involves getting rid of the internet, you should go ahead and do it. Mm. But if not, I mean, there are other ways in which you can force yourself. The key is to discipline yourself, because otherwise there are so many distractions out there, right? So many great books to read, you know, great people to follow in social media, newspapers to read, or shows to watch on TV or something, right? So it's really easy to get distracted.
But it's not just those good things. It's also, oh, look, my bookshelf needs reorganizing, yeah. A to Z. It's about, I want to do anything other than write a book.
Or the children, right? The children, yeah. Need a...
Right, the children.
I mean, looking back, I don't think I was at all disciplined. What I've found is, so I'm coming to year five now as a freelancer. I mean, I've found very clearly my natural kind of rhythm of working, when I'm best at writing and thinking and being creative, when I'm best at doing more administrative tasks. I mean, I'm terrible in the afternoon. My brain is really in a bad gear in the afternoon. So I try not to do things that will kind of grate against that. But what I found worked for me is when I got the flow, I went for it and tried to kind of exploit that momentum as much as possible. If I was sat there and I was writing a paragraph in 2 hours, I just went, right, let's do something else, because this is not the day when I'm in a good mood for writing a book. And I think one of the benefits I found was, once again, a very relaxed publisher, because I did slip on deadlines without question, but also the clarity of the structure that I began with, right back to the proposal, just stayed the same, and it just gave me such a clear framework that actually it was about dropping things into boxes more so than having to write this blank canvas in a very linear fashion. So I did find it very helpful, and a very technical thing, and I'm sure we'll mention this, but I found using Scrivener app incredibly helpful.
I was going to ask you about that experience.
Yeah, absolutely immense, because it's such a modular way of writing. So you can start writing things, you can reshuffle things as you can in Word, but it just seems more elegant, more flexible. You can collate all your research and links and stuff. I just find it a really, really useful way to kind of compose this book.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because there's another, there are many distinctions among writers. So some writers prefer to begin with a very strict and detailed outline that works as the skeleton, yeah, to the book, and then they flesh it out of that. And others begin with a much more flexible structure, or even no structure at all, just a vague idea of the topics that they want to cover. And then they just start writing, right? Like an essay. They start writing like an essay, right?
Yeah.
So that's another thing that you need to discover, what kind of writer you are, just by trying both things and see which option works better for you, or if you need some sort of middle ground in between those two approaches, the structure approach or the unstructured approach. So how flexible you can be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Because you may discover that you may begin with that happened to me, beginning with a very strict structure of what I wanted to write about, and then discover that, you know, I needed to insert something in there, or I needed to move this here or there, and it was much better to just improvise while I was point, right? So again, mm-hmm. that's a process of self-discovery that writing a book enables.
Yeah, I think the one of the questions that was also raised by Matt Johnston, we've probably covered off, but what do you think was crucial in securing a publisher? Any tips about that process? Now, personally, I was fortunate to be approached, so I didn't necessarily have to pitch. But of course, once you approach, you are then tasked with creating a convincing proposal to take to the editorial board. And you know, from my perspective, it was about, again, the idea of very quickly arriving at some sense of what this was going to be and what it was not going to be, which I think helped the clarity as my then editor promoted to the board. About you guys, what was the kind of circumstances around your kind of publishing deal? What came first, and what do you think helped? What advice would you give to others? Maybe start off with Alberto.
Yeah, I mean, I was my first book published worldwide, The Functional Art, was originally written in Spanish. So the book I was already published in Spain, and I was approached by PitchBit. They were looking for a book about visualization and say, you know, I have this one, I can just translate it and expand it and then publish it. But I have very, very unorthodox and perhaps a little bit controversial ideas about how to relate to publishers. And I expressed these ideas a while ago in a blog post, and I'm going to express them openly again. A publisher is not doing you a favor by publishing your book. You are doing a favor to the publisher to let it publish your book. That changes the relationship completely. And the blog post that I wrote a while ago, in that blog post I said, unless that you are an academic who needs to publish with an academic publisher in order to get tenure, there is not really a financial reason to publish with a publisher. Unless, it's much better to self-publish your book if you have enough following on social media. Because at the end, you are going to be the one doing most of the promotion and helping yourself, etc. What is the only reason you may want to go with a publisher? If the experience of working with that publisher is delightful, if they are really professional, if they listen to your needs, if they help you all the way to the end of the process, if they make your life easier. So in the past, the relationship between publishers and authors was a hierarchical relationship. The publisher was up here and the author was down here. Today, we are side by side, or we should be side by side. So potential authors who already have a following in social media should be aware that self-publishing is a very realistic option, very realistic option. If they have the money to print a book, which is expensive, but not as expensive as people think, to hire a good copy editor and a good designer to design the book. If you don't find a publisher that covers your need and that can treat you really, really well, self-publishing is a better option. The publishers need to step up a little bit in that sense. It seems that our experiences with our most recent books have been excellent. But in the past, you know, Andy, your experience with your previous publisher was really bad. And we all have heard, you know, horror stories from people working with other different publishers in the past. Well, we just can't get rid of that experience. We don't need that experience anymore. We don't need to work with the publisher anymore if we don't want to.
And you're also, it's perhaps the wrong word, but you're also so fragile almost as a person that if you're not just having to battle against your own mind about how to write and what to write in this book, but also battle with a publisher who's pulling you in a different direction that you don't wish to, or you actually don't know how to go into, it just makes the entire process so much more stressful and anxious ridden, and you just can't allow yourself to have that in order to create a good book, really. How about yourself, Georgia? What was your experience?
It was very easy because I already had the book written in Portuguese. I was going to self-publish. And then there was some guy came from nowhere and he said, hey, that's a good book. Let's publish it in Portuguese.
I didn't say that it was a good book. I said that it was an excellent
some guy.
I said that it was an excellent book that deserved to be published worldwide.
So I started to work with Nikki from PHPit. It was a great relationship, and it worked really well. Some people wanted suggested that I should be more Excel oriented. I didn't want that. They accepted my view, so I wrote whatever I wanted. So it was a really nice experience. I was not aware of the role, how important editors are. So I'm glad I didn't go self-publish, because I would miss that experience. I would repeat it. Probably I will self-publish somewhere in the future, but now I have that experience, and that's very, I need that.
Right, yeah.
The point about the editor is really important. That's the reason why I mentioned before that if anybody is willing to go through the self-publishing path, it is very important to find a very professional and tough editor who can help you tweak your thoughts and frame them in the correct manner and express your thoughts in the right way. It's really, really important. And it's very important to listen to that person. It's great to write the books that we want to write, but at the same time, it's great to have a second pair of eyes taking a look at what we are writing and giving you feedback. In that case, it can be your colleagues who can play that role, right? You can just submit your manuscript to people who you trust to give you a very honest review, and then they get their feedback and then implement it. But if you have a copy editor, professional copy editor, you can hire that person. That should be a priority.
Yeah.
I was going to just add to that, too, because in my experience, my editor is a bit more hands-off. But with Sage, they put out chapters once you've got those drafted for peer review, and it's anonymous. Mm. So you get feedback from, 6 to 12 people every single time you finish a chunk of the book. And that to me has been so, so valuable. And so, yeah, if you do self-publish, I think getting it out to people would be great. But I think also, to friends for sure, but I think to some people who are going to also be truthful.
Yeah. I mean, that's important. Absolutely. So we've answered all the questions, hopefully, that were raised on Twitter today. I think there's two last things that I would be dead interested to hear, which is, first of all, from all of you, what's next? Now, we know there's Return of the Jedi due. We want to know how far that goes into the Attack of the Clones, etc., etc. But also, any one or two kind of key tips, key reflections that you would like to impart to other future authors. So let's start reverse order. So start with Stephanie.
Uh-huh.
So what's next, okay, and kind of key tips and tactics, one or two things that you'd impart?
Yeah, so what's next? I'm working on the revision, a second edition to my first book. I don't know what your contract says, Andy, but mine says that I have an edition out every 4 years, more or less. So I am still promoting the second book, which just came out last month, and I'm already halfway through the revision to the first book, and I'm looking forward to a break after this. But that's what's going on right now, and I think my biggest tip in this regard, which I can't believe nobody's brought up yet, but just don't read the comments. That is the one thing I learned from the first book. Just I personally can't do it.
Just review comments, just, like on Amazon.
Yeah, I don't look at that stuff.
Yeah. Because it's very easy to take certain negative comments to heart.
Well, one person's like, well, you used CMYK here when you meant to say RGB, and it made me cry for like 2 days. Not that it was that big of a deal, but it's just like you put so much blood, sweat, and tears into it that it's my ego is too fragile, so I just don't read them.
That's a good tip.
My own strategy with comments is a strategy that I follow when I get reviews from students at the university. If only one person complains about something, it's just one person's complaint. Mm. So would you just take it and say, okay, you just read it, and that's it. If two or more people mention the same thing, then that is something that may be worth considering for your future efforts. So, for instance, I remember a couple of people who I trust saying that the functional art could have benefited from a much stronger structure, perhaps, instead of being so much as an essay. Although I like to write essays. I don't like to write textbooks. My books are written as essays. But in The Truthful Art, I try to have a little bit more solid structure. Even if the book is still an essay, it's not a textbook. It has the structure of a textbook, right? So I listen to that kind of feedback. The only way you can get that feedback is if you read the comments with an open mind and always trying to shield yourself towards single person's comments. That is not worthwhile. Everybody has an opinion about everything, right? But if two or more people mention the same thing, that is something worth considering, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So while you're there, Alberto, what is next then? What's you? Crazily, you're doing a PhD, right?
I am doing a PhD dissertation. So yeah, I have been delaying this PhD dissertation for almost 8 years. So I need to get done by the end of these years. I'm working on that right now. So it's a research project about how news infographics and data visualizations are produced today in comparison to when I began my career 15 years ago. So I'm interviewing tons of people.
That's lifetime in this field, 15 years, yeah.
Yeah, 15, almost 20 now, almost 20 years already, this field. So the field has changed a lot, as you said, right? So I want to explore what people think about those changes, how they feel about those changes, what those changes are, because I have my own assumptions, so I want to compare them to everybody else's. And also, the dissertation will also include a historical overview of infographics in the news, etc. So it will be your traditional PhD dissertation, but written with the style that I favor, which is not academic. So it will be an academic product, obviously, but written in the style that I like to use. And that should be done by the end of this year. And then right after that, immediately after that, I submit the PhD, which I should do by March next year. I need to begin working on The Return of the Jedi. The working title will be The Insightful Art. Insightful. I hope that I'm pronouncing that word correctly. So that will be the third book in the series, in which I will focus a little bit more on the visual design aspects of visualization, so typography, color. I would like to write a little bit about color myself. Graphics style guide, so how to develop a graphic style guide. Storytelling aspects, how to structure a graphic narratively, and other kinds of things that I feel that I need to cover before retiring in 2020.
I'm putting the pen down.
Yeah, exactly. Right after I publish that book, I will probably start writing about something else, because I don't know. Also about mobile design, also interactive design, but also for mobile applications. So I would like to write a little bit about that. But as I said before, right after I finish that book, I will have like 5 books about graphics already in total. The trilogy, The Functional Art, Truthful and Insightful Art, I will have those 3, plus Infografía 2.0, which is my first book in Spanish, and my PhD dissertation, I will be ready to write about, I don't know, gardening or something like that.
There you go.
A fusion between gardening and visualization. There you go. Literally.
Or a fusion between cooking and visualization. I mean, Moritz Stefaner is working on that intersection right now.
Exactly right.
Food and data visualization, right? So,
Georgia, what's next for you? Any singular kind of tips and tactics that you would impart to the next budding author?
I'd like to see someone writing about TV visualization.
Yes.
Do it.
I will not do it. because I want to do something else. That is to partner with a market research company and try to find a better way to design reports and presentations of market research surveys. So that's my most likely new book. Probably the publisher will want me to write something follow up to this book for a more Excel centered book. I don't know if they want that. I have to talk to them. But the first one about market research is the one that interests me most. Mm.
Cool.
Absolutely. Well, for me, it is about having a break. So I've kind of been relentlessly learning and writing and forming training and teaching materials for the last kind of 9 years, actually. So I need a break, and I'm going to just work, just get back into actually doing some of my own stuff, which, you know, is the thing that always is sacrificed on my to-do list, projects that I want to work on myself, because that's next for me, which is broadening my own capabilities, technically, especially, to give me the ability to do the things I'm telling others to do, so which kind of makes a lot of sense. I think there are two things that I would pass on to another author. One very practical thing, which is the hidden challenge of image permissions. Sourcing and securing permissions to use images is a difficult thing, not because the designers and creators out there don't wish their work to appear in your book. Often they're very keen on that. It's just that organizations themselves, especially newspapers and media organizations, tend to have very strict rules about the usage, and very rarely do you have the ability to pay a fee to actually pay for the graphics that you include. Mm-hmm. So that's one big thing, and you need to kind of get that really going quite early, which is difficult because there's a certain chicken and egg. Do you write about a graphic not knowing if you've secured it, or do you write about once you've got it? So that's a difficult one. The second one is it relates to a quote I heard about a movie director once saying, and forgive the language briefly, but the essence of this was that it takes a hell of a lot of work to make a shit movie. And the point being that to make a average or a good movie takes incredible amount of work, incredible amount of talent. So when you are writing a book, you hope it will be good. You hope it will be at least average. But what people don't necessarily see in whatever the end product is the sheer amount of hidden work that's gone into it. And just looking back, I have a document called spares.doc, which is all the things that I stripped out of the book. And there's so much that I didn't put in there. And there's so much, there's like a hidden part of the iceberg that goes into the efforts of writing a book. The tens of thousands of words that aren't actually included in the last version is quite terrifying when you look back and think, how much work have I put in to create this however many page book it is? So it's about not underestimating just the sheer amount of work that you'll do that won't actually end up being in the book in the form that you initially created it at. So going back to the idea of managing time, it's a very big thing.
I think that the key there, Andy, is that, and again, I believe that is something that we will all sympathize, an idea that we all sympathize with. It's learning to enjoy not the end product, but learning to enjoy the process. Yes. You're always talking about process, right? The process of discovering a visualization. For me, whenever I create an infographic, both in the present and also in the past, what I enjoyed the most was not publishing the graphic. What I enjoyed the most was the process, right? Reading the information, contacting the sources, getting the information, getting the data, or creating the animations or the statistical charts. I enjoyed the process, right? It's the same thing with books. It's the same thing with writing books. You need to teach yourself to enjoy the process of writing them, regardless of what the end product will be, because no book will ever be perfect. And there are some people who get stuck trying to create a perfect product. There's not such a thing. Yeah. So there's one point in which you need to say, enough. This is good enough. It needs to be published right away so I can move on. And then, you know, what I mentioned before, I mean, this is all related, right? Learning to enjoy the process is another thing, another technique or another tool that you can use to discipline yourself. Because I don't trust and I don't believe in inspiration at all. I mean, I am the less inspired people in the world. I have learned that the only way I can write is if I force myself to sit down, switch on the computer, and start writing. Even if what you write is complete crap, you can edit it later. You can improve it later. But at least you need to sit down and start writing. And do it in a very, if you can do it, I know that everybody has different schedules, but do it in a systematic manner. So certain times of the day, certain days if you can, or in a specific place. Don't write all over the place. Just choose one place that will be your writing place, and sit down and start doing it, and then enjoy the process, obviously.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think we've reached a natural conclusion there. So, some wonderful tips and tactics there. Thank you, everyone, for taking part. Thank you for people who sent in the questions and who will ever listen to this audio. So, I guess we'll all cross-publish this on our related platforms so we can spread the word, and we'll all make sure that the links to each of our books are published there. So, thank you from me. Thank you to Alberto. Thank you to Jorge. Thank you to Stephanie for a really insightful last hour. So, that's the end of this special book club. The first rule of which is don't mention book club, but do mention this book club. And we'll maybe pass on the baton to the next four publishers out there. I know there's Stephanie and Georgia releasing Dear Data. There's some other people got books in the pipeline, so maybe we'll pass on the baton for them to a similar exercise in a few months. So that's the end of the session. Thanks, guys, and see you all later.